Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life. Just be
different. And this is Dr. Peter Bregan. You know, technology is a problem. I went on to get on the show today, and my Skype decided 3 minutes before the show that it was going to tell me about its all-new program. And by the time I got through trying to get rid of the learning lessons for the all-new program, I had to run down the hall and say, Ginger, Ginger, I'm having technology problems. And Ginger came in, and Ginger rescued me from my technology problems. I guess, you know, I've got to check out Skype an hour ahead of time nowadays to make sure that, indeed, it isn't going to give me some new problems to deal with. So let me start in a little different way. Just check out my guest right away. Gary, are you there?
Yes, I am, Peter. I'm here.
Oh, good. So, folks, everything is running. I've got my guest. I've got myself. I can now tell my wife that she's free to leave the room and go about her business. You know, technology is wonderful, but it does have its drawbacks. We were just cleaning out our basement of research files that I've had for 40, 30 years or more. Some of them go back to the early 70s when I was conducting my international campaign to stop psychosurgery, which was largely successful. And I realize how different it is now with digital saving of materials. It's like I looked at 10 boxes about ECT. I literally have about 15 boxes of just about ECT, I mean cartons. And I realized that just about everything I need has now been digitalized. Now, I suppose somebody might someday want to do a history of that, but they're not going to be able to because it's going to go to the masher and get all shredded up. My book is out, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, folks, and it's had by far the best response of any book I've had in the last 20 years. It's very near to within a week selling out the first printing. I'm just really excited that people are glad to hear from me about positive, uplifting alternatives. I did 2 hours on Coast to Coast with Gary Null and with George Norrie. I'm hoping to do Gary Null this week with George Norrie, who is just the kindest gentleman in the world, a very loving show host. And it gave the book a great shot. And actually, I need to be reminded myself to get in touch with Gary and because we were arranging to be on his show this week. So you can still get the book at a real bargain on our website. The book sells for $19. You can probably get it on Amazon for $14 or $15. From us for $16, you get 2 books. You'll get the Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Your Negative Emotions, and you will also get the Antidepressant Fact Book, which costs about $15 on Amazon and on our site. So you're actually getting 2 real books. Because they had overstocked storage space. The book's still in print, Antidepressant, but they gave us a bunch at a lower price, so we're able to do this for you because they wanted to save storage space. You know, everybody wants to go digital on demand. They can print on demand now. And we already got an order in for a second printing on Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety. I hope they do that on demand and keep the books flowing. I really hope you read it. It's a book I have written to liberate people emotionally. If you want to know how I've managed to to do what I do under threat of, over the years, of everything from total public humiliation to losing my license to being killed. The whole range of stuff, and how does a person come through that spiritually intact and even grow and get stronger and do better? It's all in getting rid of guilt, shame, and anxiety, because you may think you deserve to feel guilty. You may think that, of course, you feel ashamed when you want to do something different and new and spectacular, or just plain creative, or your own. Or if you feel anxious when you think about having a better life and creating a better marriage and creating better relationships and doing more things that you want, well, guilt, shame, and anxiety, I'm here to tell you, you don't need them. You actually don't. And there is a way around them. There is a way to run your life by reason and love. And this book is the culmination of my thinking about these things for 40 years. I've actually made 3 or 4 drafts of this book before I got it just right. And those drafts started literally 35 or 40 years ago. So that's how long I've been trying to figure out, what is this all about, all these negative emotions? And my looking at evolution, biological evolution, was very helpful in understanding why we would have certain things that we just don't need anymore. And it's got checklists and all those kinds of things to help you decide if indeed you're struggling with guilt, with shame, or anxiety, how it affects your life, and how it can be overcome. To my surprise, I even got a good establishment book review. I don't get good establishment book reviews, generally speaking. But Publishers Weekly called Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety an engrossing self-help book. And then went on to just really speak nicely about it. It's on Bregan.com. And, you know, an engrossing self-help book. And it's an educational self-help book. And I do hope you will find it engrossing, as you undoubtedly will, my interview today with Gary Sidley. Gary is another one of the Brits that we have been bringing to you. Why is there a disproportionate number of British folks on the radio with me? It isn't because they're the only ones who will come on. I promise you that. It's actually more interesting in Great Britain, the psychology issues being raised, the psychiatry issues being raised, the criticisms, the experiments. They are definitely better in Great Britain. Now, this contradicts one of my theories, which is that socialized medicine will stultify all experimentation. That's a theory I have. Now, I've got facts that say, yeah, you got to relook at that theory a little bit. I think that somehow the socialization of national health care, the national health care program in Great Britain, has managed to keep the drug companies a small percentage more at bay than here in the U.S. You know, here in the U.S., one of the ways that we got Obamacare was that the Obama administration, agreed to allow the drug companies to go on charging whatever they wanted, and that would be covered by the government. That was one of their unholy compromises. And I don't think it's quite like that in Great Britain. I don't think the drug companies have complete control over the government in quite the same way they do here. So today we're going to have another gentleman. We've had ladies, women, and men from Great Britain. Gary got my attention through a blog that he did on his own website, Gary Sidley, S-I-D-L-E-Y. He's a psychologist. And in that website, he had a chart about the difference between your life if you're a psychiatric patient and your life if you're a person without a psychiatric label. And in this chart, he points out that if you're a psychiatric patient, you're unjustly seen as a significant risk to other people automatically, whereas you're not if you're not a psychiatric patient. You're also at risk of incarceration without indulging, as he says, in any criminal activities. You're at risk of incarceration without a court trial. See, England is the same, and it's all this in the Western world, probably most of the world. You're excluded from valued social roles. Absolutely. Once you have this mark on you, you may have very great difficulty getting anything from a gun license to becoming a traffic controller or any other thing where they're likely to screen you, or maybe even just general employment. You're going to have more abuse and harassment than the person who's not labeled. You can be more readily forced to take very toxic drugs while you're living in the community or be locked up. See, it's the same in Great Britain as here. And, decisions you make in advance to refuse psychiatric treatment are just going to be ignored. Nobody's going to pay attention to what your surrogate says, even if you appoint your wife or your mother. I've got a case like that right now in the U.S. So Gary is retired, in his own words, as a psychologist, and he does other interesting things that are really closely related. He's doing interesting blogs. He's got an interesting blog, as you see, and he's got a new book coming out next year. It's going to compete with my book, so I won't mention it. No, it's Tales from the Madhouse. I like that. Tales from the Madhouse, an insider critique of psychiatric services. They like that term in Great Britain, psychiatric services. They ought to say psychiatric abuses by and large. But Tales from the Madhouse, an insider critique of psychiatric services, is going to be published by PCCS Books in January 2015. Interestingly enough, there's a publisher in Great Britain that's doing a lot of work with the alternative viewpoint, and there's a book coming out that'll have a chapter of mine in it in PCS Books. So England's a little different, a little bit more able to do things, and I'm going to leave it now to my new friend Gary L. Sidley to tell you about new things in Great Britain, new things in his life. Hi, Gary.
Hello there.
I'm a little puffing, still recovering from Skype telling me it was going to train me.
A few degrees, not many, I don't think, as far as the drug companies are concerned. And the table that you read from about the rights of a psychiatric patient, I think probably are equivalent to that of a suspected terrorist, really. It seems on a par with, so they do have a bad time both here and in the USA and across the Western world, as you quite rightly pointed out. What I'd like to do, Peter, if it's all right, is just to quickly outline what might be called my personal journey to disillusionment with Western psychiatry. Would that be okay?
I love personal journeys, and I'm sure my audience does too. It just tells us the most. Go ahead.
Okay, I'll be relatively brief with it because I don't want to.
No, you don't have to be. Go. Okay. Go.
Okay, that's very kind of you, because I think personal journeys that I've read mainly have been around service users and the way, quite rightly, the experiences they've had on their journey through the system. I suppose this is from a professional perspective, really, and my journey started back in 1980 as a naive 21-year-old who'd recently got a biochemistry degree from university and decided he, for whatever reason, he wanted to enter the psychiatric world. So I started in 1980, age 21, as a nursing assistant on an acute admission ward where I was introduced for the first time in my life to people labelled with things like schizophrenia and manic depression, which of course is what tends to be referred to as bipolar disorder these days. So I started in 1980, and then in 1981 I moved to a large psychiatric hospital, the old Prestwich Asylum, which is a large psychiatric hospital based in Manchester, which apparently was the largest asylum in Europe back in the 1900s, housing around 3,000 inmates, so a huge place. And I did my nursing training, so I started to train as a psychiatric nurse, and then spent 6 years within the large psychiatric hospital in a variety of roles, as a student nurse, then a staff nurse as I got promoted, then a charge nurse, and then a senior nurse. And while I was doing my nursing, I was studying psychology in my spare time, like an open university degree where you can study part-time. Don't know whether you have anything equivalent in America. You probably have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. So I get, getting go my ahead, though. I just want you to continue with your story.
Okay, fine.
So you're nursing. So you're now you're in a giant facility, and then you're moving on. Go ahead.
Yeah, got my psychology degree, and then in 1987 went to do my clinical psychology training and qualified as a clinical psychologist in 1989, and then spent the subsequent 24 years of my career working as a clinical psychologist in adult services, so with people 18 and over, in a variety of clinical areas, inpatient settings, community mental health centres, homes, primary care health centres.
Take us back to the disillusionment, which was you were going to tell us about. Where does that start?
Sorry, I didn't quite catch you there, Peter.
Take us back to the disillusionment, and where does that begin in this career?
Right, well, I was just about to come to that, because in writing this book since my retirement last year, you know, when I've reflected on my career and really looked in detail at my experiences, it seems that I can break down my journey into three phases. Phase one, I think, was in the 1980s, which I could call collusion with the system. So this was collusion with biological psychiatry, really. I was there with my biochemistry degree and therefore quite receptive, I suspect, to ideas about brain defects and biochemical imbalances. So in that early stage of my career, as a nurse, you know, I did dish out the toxic medications three times a day from the trolley, you know, the chlorpromazine syrup. Is it Thorazine over there in the USA?
Started about the same time as with you, maybe a few months later. Starts in France in 53. It's you and I in 1954.
Okay, so I was dishing out chlorpromazine syrup, dishing out depot injections, helping with electroconvulsive therapy, and forcibly drugging individuals occasionally, I'm ashamed to say. I did learn a lot about the various forms of human suffering, I think, around that time, and misery. I learned a lot in many ways, and I still like to think that I showed compassion, but I'm not proud of some of those practices which I colluded with in that early stage of my career. And then I entered the phase two, which was in the 1990s, which I could call this seeking change from within. So this is where I was beginning my clinical psychology career, and I had the notion that I could make a difference working within the system. You know, that by engaging in my talking therapies with my service users, by liaising with like-minded colleagues, and promoting pockets of good practice, trying to educate and influence other people in the system, and trying to counter the excesses of biological psychiatry, I actually thought during this phase that I could make a difference from within, actually working within the system as it stands here in the UK and indeed across the Western world. And I always remember a learned colleague of mine urging me to try and pursue evolution rather than revolution. He was trying to calm me down, I think, saying, Gary, do not try to be too ambitious at this stage, you know, try and achieve incremental change within the system. Evolution, not revolution. So I did actually believe I could make some difference at that point, I think. But I do remember reading some of your work at that stage, Peter, as well. I think during the 1990s, I recall reading your Toxic Psychiatry book. And a fair bit of that did resonate with me at that time, where you talked about a plague of brain damage caused by neuroleptic drugs, about how psychiatry, rather than treating a disease, that the neuroleptics were creating a disease. And this particular quote from your book about 20 years, the profession simply failed to notice that a large percentage of its patients was twitching and reeling from the drugs. I do remember reading those extracts, and they did have an impact on me at the time, and I did start to reflect on the people I'd worked with, particularly in the old psychiatric asylum, who were twitching and reeling and drooling, and that did accelerate some of my growing doubts and disillusionment about biological psychiatry. But if I'm not,
thank you for that. It always warms my heart. And as anyone who listens regularly knows, I'm just always surprised that the guests that Ginger and I select to come on, who are doing the best work, so often bring this up. It makes this long life of reform work feel worthwhile. So thank you for that.
You were clearly decades ahead of many of us, Peter. You know, and I've often wondered how you've managed to have the resilience to continue through such a long period of time to argue for alternative approaches. You know, your life must have been, I could imagine your life must have been hell, really, with some of the reactions that you would have got.
It was a nightmare at times,
on
every possible level, from life threats to humiliations and so on and so forth. It's quite peaceful by comparison, although I never know when the roof might fall in, and I'm always prepared. Anybody out there, I'm always prepared, and have huge numbers of supporters now, just huge, in government and, you know, in the media, in the profession. So I've been left alone more, but it was. And actually, I really do try to explain that in Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, that I really think that coming to grips with the negative emotions from childhood has allowed me to deal in such better ways with adulthood, no matter what gets thrown at me. So I really do believe that. Go on. What were some of the other early readings? Lang was out by then, and Long out by then, and Zaz.
Yes, there was some quotes from Lang about the power of the power within the psychiatrist's eyes. I think was much more frightening than the powerless look in his patients. Words to that effect, I think, wasn't it, from Lang?
Yes.
I recall. I think that was a good quote, and Satch with his comparisons with witch hunts, I thought was appropriate. But if I'm 100% honest, though, Peter, at that time in the 1990s, I still had this kind of sense that just maybe you were overstating it a little bit. You know, I just didn't swallow the whole thing at that time. Perhaps I was a slow learner, Peter. it took a while, but at that time, I didn't fully accept that the psychiatric approach psychiatric approach could cause so much damage. Obviously, those views have changed now, because by the time the year 2000 came, and between 2000 and 2013, I entered the third phase of my professional journey, which I could call the increasing recognition of a need for a paradigm shift. So I started to recognize that I couldn't really achieve much, or me and like-minded people couldn't really achieve anything significant and enduring within the current paradigm of biological psychiatry, because anything that you tried to do ultimately was eroded by these really deeply held assumptions that the biological psychiatrists had. And the problem, of course, is that it wasn't just the biological psychiatrists who had these assumptions, it was often the senior managers as well within the system. So that when you did try and support and work with good pockets of practice, and of course there are many, many people within the system from every profession who are good people who are trying to make a difference, but even when you tried to work with those people, it's always seemed as if you couldn't really progress, because the dominant culture and the dominant paradigm would eventually wear you down and block your progress. And so during that period, I really started to recognize the damaging consequences of the dominance of biological psychiatry. And the negative consequence of this illness, like any other mantra as well. And I know sometimes I do get some flack from people on the various sites when I suggest that the illness, like any other sort of mantra, is a really, really unhelpful one. I get accused of being lacking compassion, or occasionally I get accused of being a Scientologist as well. I'm sure you've had that one many times.
Everybody who says anything critical of psychiatry, that's the first thing they come up with is your Scientology.
Well, that's reassuring that it's not just me then.
It's everybody. It's every last person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's useful to know. And so it dawned on me that it was futile, really, trying to change this system that was managerially and clinically dominated by medical model and biological psychiatry assumptions. And so I started to conclude, rather belatedly, really, that we really did need a radical shift. And I guess that's been the motivation for my book that I've been working on for the last 18 months quite intensively, is to use that experience to try and make a contribution to what is, of course, a growing literature of voices that are not happy with the way things are going with mental health and who are asking, indeed demanding, some radical shift in emphasis.
And Gary, this is interesting. This gives me an idea for the second half of the show. I've never just spent a half an hour talking about what would a radical shift look like.
Right.
So we're going to take a break in a minute or two, but I think one of the things we might do when we come back, and it would get people more interested in your book, which comes out in January. And by the way, tell folks how they can get to your blog and stay in touch with when your book comes out.
Yeah, they can get to my blog on gsidley, so that's G-S-I-D-L-E-Y, hubpages.com.
Say it one more time.
So it's gsidley.hubpages.com. C-O-M.
Tell me, spell the middle part.
Hubpages is H-U-B-P-A-G-E-S. Hubpages.
Okay. And I'm sure, as I've done, if you just do Gary Sidley, especially if you do Gary L. Sidley, you'll have no trouble getting to him.
That's right. You'll get through there. And there will be a dedicated website entitled TalesFromTheMadhouse.com that's currently in design and will be up and running in the next 2 weeks. But that's not quite there yet.
Well, folks, hang in for the second half. And let's see what Gary and I can do talking about something I've never really done before on the air, I think, in any show, which is what in the world would an ideal system for what we're talking about look like? What would it be called? What would it do? Let's go to break and come back to an interesting half hour. And this is Dr. Peter Breggin. You can call me Peter. Anyway, my guest, Gary Sidley from Great Britain. His book coming out in January is Tales from the Madhouse. And it has a final chapter on a blueprint for mental health, which I think leads us very nicely into something I've not really done much on the air, which is to envision what would a more ideal system look like? Gary, why don't you start? What's your vision of how we should go about what we now call mental health services?
A radical change that would involve us looking at different levels of society and how we respond to human suffering and how we respond to human misery, and indeed how we might prevent it as well, because I think that's probably important. And for simplicity, I tend to look at it at two levels. The first is about promoting and strengthening what we might call existing pockets of good practice. And the second is about more radical whole system change. So, don't know which one of those you'd prefer.
Let's do whole system change. Let's go for it.
Let's go for the big one first. Okay. I think I'm not alone in asking for this. This is not my idea on its own, but I think it's a good one, and that is I think we should shift our focus from that of treating mental illness to that of focusing on the promotion of mental well-being as like a broader term, rather than treating mental illness. Because I think well-being depends on so many things. You know, it will depend on environmental aspects, you know, where you live, whether you're in a job, whether you've got involved in decent relationships, whether you're not constantly feeling fearful about the prospect of crime on your doorstep. Yeah. So I think mental well-being is a much broader and much more appropriate construct for us to focus on. And in the UK, I know it's probably different over in the USA, but in the UK, I'd shift the primary responsibility for mental health away from our NHS, away from our National Health Service. Our National Health Service is a wonderful institution that's great for responding to physical illnesses. I think, you know, if you have a heart attack, if you have a cardiac problem, if you have kidney stones, if you've got stomach ulcers, it's a wonderful institution. You know, free at the point of access, great. But as far as dealing with mental health, because it's so associated with the medical paradigm and the culture of the NHS is such that no matter how you try, we're always going to suffer the disadvantages of a illness like any other mentality. So it's stigmatizing, it induces passivity, it tends to encourage a lack of compassion. It gives opportunities for misusing power within the system. It's discriminatory. It tends to quash people's aspirations. So there's a whole range of disadvantages, I believe, associated with the illness like any other mantra. And the NHS...
So if you pull it out of NHS, where does it go? And folks, we're going to have to face this problem in the U.S. because unless we get some radical change politically, we will have an NHS. Where would you go outside the NHS? How would you do this?
I think it'd be a much more social service, so it would come under our social care kind of.
So under the government, but under the social care services.
Yes. And I think to achieve this, and it is an ambitious suggestion, and some might call me a little bit idealistic and naive, but I think there's a growing number of people who are having a similar view, and that is that it would need something akin to a ministerial department of well-being. You know, somebody in government, a governmental department that could oversee societal changes to counter inequalities, you know, to promote access to opportunities, reduce homelessness and unemployment. And a big one, of course, and one that you'll know more about than I, Peter, given your specialist knowledge with younger people, and that is, you know, to counter child neglect and abuse, which is, you know, it seems really bizarre that we put such a relatively small proportion of our budget around mental health into prevention and actually getting into families that are struggling, getting into family situations where a child is suffering neglect or physical or sexual abuse, because anyone who's worked in the mental health services know just what a potent contributory factor those kinds of abuses and neglect are in the subsequent development of mental health problems.
Let me interrupt a minute. The problem I have with the approach you're taking is that you're basically just shifting over the government to looking at political and social factors to alleviate suffering, and that just becomes a whole idea that that politics are again a solution to this. I mean, that's the problem, I would say. We actually did this in the U.S. in 1962 was the last gasp of this in the U.S. There was a National Commission on Mental Health, really, a mental illness and maybe mental health. It focused on mental health. It was from NIMH. It was an attempt to reframe everything in a psychosocial way. And in fact, the volunteer program that I helped develop at Harvard and college students was written up as one of the one of the ways, get volunteers involved, and we got a lot of good encouragement from that. But once the government got involved and was, you know, and set up these community mental health centers around the country, we had a Community Mental Health Center Act, and they were supposed to provide lots of other services, it just deteriorated over the years into you know, clinics to get drugs. That's what we got now between 1962 and now. Yeah. I'm not sure what's radical about what you're saying. So let me challenge you a little bit on
that. Okay, that's fine. I'm suggesting that political change is necessary. It's not sufficient to achieve what we're looking for, but I think it's necessary because without that kind of political clout, nothing will change. You know, within the National Health Service over here in the UK, you know, there are areas of good practice. You know, there are, as I tried to describe earlier, there are initiatives where people are trying to introduce recovery approaches, which is like a much more person-centered, empowering, optimistic approach to mental health, which, you know, there's some good work going on there, but it's always stifled by the system in which we operate. So I think we have to get out of the health system, because otherwise
that for
defaulting.
Sure, I do think that.
Yeah,
I don't know that
defaulting.
You know, that working on things that we need to do in our culture anyway, you know, which is help poverty and God, we need to do so much about child abuse and so on.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's all well and good, but I just don't know how that's going to change the particular issue we're looking at, which is what do we do with the people who just don't manage at all? Let me give you an alternative. This is really freewheeling for me today. I apologize for interrupting and shifting here. But let's suppose we view the issues we're dealing with as more about on a model of religion than on a model of government. That is, that helping people overcome human suffering is simply not something governments are going to be good at, or social services are going to be good at, or professionals per se are going to be good at. Suppose we opened up the whole idea of human suffering and handed it back to the general public and to private resources. For example, if you wanted to be trained as a therapist who believed in Christian approaches, you could do that. If you were psychoanalytically oriented, you could do that. The state didn't license. Nobody licensed. We broke the whole darn professional model and said, let's open up to the reality that easing personal suffering, it's hard to separate from poverty. It's hard to separate from all these other things, because obviously poverty makes it worse, child abuse makes it worse, sexism, racism makes it worse, war makes it worse. But suppose we just said, look, let's get rid of the government, let's get rid of licensing, let's open this whole area up to all the alternatives. You want to go to people who are trained by Peter Bregan, you can. You want to go to people trained by Gary, you can. That to me would seem like a maybe a more hopeful and genuinely radical approach. Could you think of giving up the whole professional nonsense model from my viewpoint?
Do I think you should give up the
I don't think I've ever challenged a guest in his ideas so much. So,
no, that's okay. I'm not sure we're necessarily at different ends of the spectrum here at all, because I agree, I don't think governments can make it happen, but I think without governmental change, they can obstruct. And now the things that you've described there, actually liberating a whole range of alternative approaches, whether they be religiously based, psychosocially based, cognitive behavior therapy based, psychodynamically based, but releasing a whole range of alternatives to be able to...
Yeah, and without state licensing, without government licensing, because all that does is create new trades, raise the prices, make people think this guy knows something because he's got a license from the government when he doesn't necessarily, she doesn't necessarily know a thing.
I agree entirely with you on that one, Peter. I think technology, sadly, even psychological therapists, some of them anyway, have become like a technology. And a number of privileged individuals claim to have the kind of rights to a particular approach and then start to ask everybody else to pay to train to become a bit like them, and it becomes big business and a bit of an industry. So I do think the solutions do lie in looking at the voluntary sector here in the UK, looking at some of the really good third sector organisations.
And trying to get the government out. In this country, if you want to set up a clinic to help people come off psych drugs, you have to make believe basically it's something else, or you have to develop an entire medical facility to do it in. You've got to have some sort of medical people doing it. You've got to have meet all the health stuff. Rather, you just can't even get away with necessarily saying this is a religious retreat where we take you off drugs, because you might run into all kinds of state health interventions. I really think the main barrier we face is the collusion between the licensing that the professionals all want, so they have extra powers and extra money and a monopoly, and the government licensing them. I haven't talked about this, by the way, in detail in a long time. I'd like to see that model broken. Is anybody thinking that way in Great Britain?
We need to move away from it being seen as so technological, because I think ultimately it's not that complicated. I think if people occupy a valued role in life, if they have decent relationships, if they have a decent social circle, if they feel they belong to something, if they have a reasonable view of themselves as being worthwhile individual, I'm not sure we'd have any problems with mental health issues particularly if we could achieve that. And I think the government obstructs rather than, I don't want the government to intervene more, I just want the government, for instance, to redistribute some of the funds. A lot of funds, not the bulk of the funds, go into supporting biological psychiatry at the moment here in the UK. And I'd like to see that redistributed to nurture some alternative approaches, some of which you've mentioned with the various psychosocial, religious, any alternative approaches to well-being, really. Like the Hearing Voices Network, which you're probably familiar with, Peter. Voices Network.
We've had folks from the network on our show, the Hearing Voices Network.
Normalizing some unusual experiences, giving people a forum to explore the meaning of some of their unusual experiences and to try and understand them on the basis of some of the past experiences. There are some good bits out there, but I think they just need far more resource and far more help to be able to spread the word. So, I think it's a combination of things. I'm not sure we're that far apart, really, with our views.
Yeah.
The other big one for me, I've probably not got time to go into it in a lot, is the mental health legislation, which I'm sure your expertise in would probably agree. The discriminatory nature of some of our mental health legislation, I think that needs to be revised. And there are alternative proposals out there which seem to make sense to me, like the smuggler stuff, the fusion law. I don't know whether you've heard of...
No, talk about that, please.
Well, I think Smuggler argues, like I did in that blog that you referred to earlier, that the Mental Health Act, as it stands here in the UK, is fundamentally discriminatory against people with mental health problems. And he said it's discriminatory, and it's such a bad law because it's emerged from a different source than some of the other laws that we have. Like we have laws around mental capacity, which purely based on people's capacity and wherewithal to make their own decisions and their best interests. And it seems, here in the UK, we have two systems running parallel. We've got the Mental Health Act legislation and we've got the Mental Capacity Act legislation. And Schmuckler argues that we don't need both. We can just have the capacity and best interest law. And we don't need to mention mental illness at all. You could just use capacity to make their own decisions and best interests as the way of deciding, you know, things like whether it, you know, whether to insist on people being you know, coerced into care. We don't need any kind of reference to mental illness. We don't need any reference to risk to others. We just need capacity and best interest. And I don't claim to be an expert in the legal aspects. I'm sure from your own experiences, you know, you've got much more in-depth knowledge of this than I. But it does seem that the Mental Health Act really is quite a poisonous bit of legislation, because a lot of things around perceptions of dangerousness and stigma and that seem to follow from some of the consequences of the Mental Health Act.
You know, you raise an issue that is really the toughest one in the field, which is, what do you do when somebody is just flat out obviously incapacitated? Now, clearly we have instances where people are come into a hospital, for example. I see these in cases all the time, where they literally are so filled with agitation, anguish, hallucinations, unawareness of where they are, or sometimes even who they are, or they're completely mute. And the question is, you know, how to help that person and protect that person at the same time. And I think what maybe this is the direction you're going in, that whatever laws we have for involuntary treatment should be so structured that they would touch only those people who literally are so harmed that they can't even say, I don't want treatment. They can't say anything. But it's such a slippery slope. I mean, it's such a difficult thing, because clearly if mom or dad is unable to manage their finances and is, you know, giving away their wealth to and their ability even to care for themselves to a con man, we would like to be able to intervene in some fashion and have mom, the control of mom's finances taken over by somebody else. But then right away you have children taking advantage of their parents. This is really tough stuff.
Area. But I do think the capacity and best interests kind of guidelines, you know, would help to resolve some of those areas.
Well, you know, we have a different concept here in the U.S., which is a very important one, which is not best interests at all. It's what would the person want. So in this country, technically, if you are incapacitated and a guardian is appointed, we call them guardian ad litem, or some other surrogate person is appointed, by and large, they're not supposed to necessarily just to do best interest. They're supposed to do what would the person want under the same circumstances, including, for example, refusing a medication and dying because they have never wanted medications. Mm-hmm. So that's another thing to throw into this hopper is the right of people to do what they would have wanted to do if they'd been able to.
Yeah, that's not dissimilar from what would be the case in the UK when I talk about best interest. You know, like, when you actually get into that, it is about trying to gather evidence as to what this individual would have wanted if they'd been able to express themselves or make an informed choice. So, you know, I think it's quite similar. I mean, with reference to your comment about people in crisis, yes, of course, we would need, you know, many easily accessible crisis houses to support people who are in acute phase and who are very distressed and clearly need the containment and respite. But again, I'd argue that they don't need to be within a hospital setting. I think we could, you know, we can, and there are models out there where that's been done with small supported units. And I think we should be looking at that rather than bringing them into a medicalized hospital environment.
Yeah. I think all of these things, I think one of the, you know, the will make so little progress as long as all of this is seen as some sort of health issue, as you're saying, but also some sort of government issue and some sort of professional issue. Human suffering has been with us since time began. It's always going to be with us. We are never going to come near eradicating it. But what we can at least do is continue to evolve of providing opportunities to people. And right now, in both the England and the U.S., it's virtually impossible to provide opportunities that are genuinely like the havens of the 18th century, where you could keep the doctors out and set up what you wanted and call it a basically a religious retreat like the Quakers did in Great Britain, like the Tukes did.
Moral treatment, kind of immoral.
Yeah,
moral
yeah. Therapy. And it's got to find a way to have them outside, I think, outside the whole system. And otherwise, it's just constantly going to be perverted. But, you know, in a way, that's pretty utopian on my part, because how in the world are we ever going to take this system now where the government colludes with every power source, psychiatry, medicine, pharmaceutical industry, and sets the rules, and then the rules always favor the people they're set for, and you end up with, you know, you can't do this unless you're a psychologist, you can't do this unless you have this license or that license. Boy, I'd like to see the whole thing come apart, folks, and be able to pick a therapist or a hospital in the same way you pick your church or your minister, that it's something that is, there's a wall between it and the government. That's what we need. We need a wall. I never thought of this. We need a wall between the government and services to alleviate personal suffering. Wow.
Yeah,
I don't know. That's utopian. Am I making any sense?
No, I agree with most of what you're saying, Peter. I don't think there's a great deal of difference. It's just, I think we both want to get to the same place. It's just about how the route we take. I'm somewhat optimistic that major change is afoot, really, because of, well, for a number of reasons, but not least because of the current pressures on the public purse. And I think, obviously, politicians here and I'm sure over there are looking at ways that they might be able to cut costs on public services. And the danger, of course, is that no money or no funding goes to the good bits. But I think we could redistribute funds here in the UK away from the current NHS-led system and use it to support alternative approaches, as we've mentioned, and we could probably make a better service at a cheaper price, and that might actually get political ears twitching, if you see what I mean.
Well, I do think there's more possibility of that in Great Britain. In the US right now, if you proved that you could help people without drugs, it would get shut down. My last guest on the show is a gentleman who's just done a huge amount to show that that people labeled with schizophrenia do better without drugs over the long over the long haul, and he's got 25, 30 years of research, and the government just cut him off. Just when he's really
like the
showing
project,
the years and years, just how wonderful this is.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, interesting. It's like the Soteria project with Mosher, isn't it? That lost funding eventually.
Yeah, they cut Mosher off, and they threw him out of NIH, too. And that's, folks, the Soteria house. But, England has a little bit more of a tradition of developing collaborations with private sector in the mental health field to do things that are somewhat innovative. But I really would like to see this this whole idea of helping human suffering as being much more like going to church and getting a minister than going to a professional licensed by the government
away from the technology, stopping it being a technological process and more a social, spiritual one.
I think so, and I think we badly need this. So we're drawing to a close here, folks. I found this interesting because I've started to talk about some things I should be talking much more about and haven't. My guest today, Gary L. Sidley, S-I-D-L-E-Y. You can find him that way on the web. He's got a book coming out in January, and it's Tales from the Madhouse, an insider critique of psychiatric services. Were you trying to say something, Gary?
Can I just give you the publisher's website, because it can be pre-ordered from there at the moment?
Yeah, well, it's PCCS, P as in Peter,
yes.
C as in continent, C as in continent, S as in safe.
books.co.uk is the actual website.
Yeah. Well, just go in there, folks. Plug in PCCS books and you'll get there. And you can pre-order his book. And when you're done there, you can actually go on to Amazon or any of the other big websites and order Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety as well. I wish us both luck with our books in the coming new year, sir.
Yep, sounds like you don't need luck given the amount of sales you've had.
We all need blessings anyway. Thanks for being on the show.
Pleasure. My pleasure.